Downtown on a snowy Wednesday, Rich Kimble, Kerry Haskell, our Zone Radio studios at his palatial estate down on the coast. Bruce Pratt joins us. We told him to stay off the roads today. You're better off right there. Bruce, how are you?
I am well, and it is snowing very hard in Swanville at the moment.
Well, yeah, you stay put right there, but we'll continue our Sports Lit 101 conversations about this terrific collection, Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles, and we're joined on the phone line by one of the contributors to the book, Steve Hardy. Steve, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure, Rich.
Really fascinating piece about some of our great moments in hockey and a very different way that people remember the Miracle on Ice and the forgotten Miracle on Ice of 1960.
You bet. In fact, USA Hockey did a movie. There have been a couple of documentaries actually called The Forgotten Miracle. Worth remembering, when I grew up in Greater Boston playing hockey in that cohort that included Jack Parker and Jerry York, who were a little older than me, all of us were very much motivated by that 1960 gold medal. So I think a whole generation got into hockey in a big way and thought of themselves as hockey people, in part because of that victory.
This is Bruce. One of the things I thought that you really did a good job of bringing up in the article is that, you know, the 1980 miracle became politicized because of the Russian invasion of Afghanistan and who's coming, who's not going to the Olympics. The 72 Summit Series was just dripping with political stuff. 68 in Mexico City. But 1960, as you point out, was as pivotal a year in the Cold War as any, yet it never became quite as politicized, that victory.
And it's always dangerous to play what-if history, I think, Bruce, but it could have become much more of a flashpoint in people's memories if the Cold War had been in a much hotter spot at that point. And, of course, Khrushchev had a trip to the U.S. in the fall of 59 and laughed and joked his way around, lost or won, depending on your point of view, the great kitchen debate with Richard Nixon. But all in all, things looked like they were going to take a little smoother course in the Cold War and in fact, made it through the Olympics in California, in Squaw Valley, but then heated up again with the U-2 and shooting down the spy plane and then Castro and Cuba, and suddenly it was hot again. But for that moment, there was a thaw. So, yeah, that certainly may have contributed to some of the loss of memory of 1960.
Would any part of that also be the fact that it was really that 1960 team was a bunch of guys from War Road, Minnesota? They weren't, you know, for the most part, guys who were going to play in the pros. I know McCartan came up with the Rangers right after that. But do you think in any way, because it was sort of more of the average Joe playing for the team, that it became more the story of them winning and less of them beating the Soviets?
Well, I think beating the Soviets was a big deal, but the fact that Americans generally, at that point in time, American hockey players, for the most part, didn't even think about the NHL as a career possibility, because among other things, the rules for American hockey and international amateur hockey were restricted checking to first the defensive zone, and then I think when I was early in high school, it went up to the center line and then up to the forward blue line, but it still was restricted checking for forwards in particular. So for the most part, Canadian scouts didn't look favorably upon the game as it was played by Europeans in the international circles or by American collegiates. So most of us didn't even think about a pro career. That began to change dramatically, as I say in that chapter, by 69, when the IIHF, under very strong lobbying by Clarence Campbell and the NHL, and the NCAA in 1972, both shifted to the NHL rules in regarding checking. Then, 72, as you mentioned, the Summit Series opened up a lot of people's eyes to the potential for Europeans to play, not just the Russians. And the WHA began, the World Hockey Association, opening up all kinds of opportunities for players. They needed talented players. So all of these things began to open up the vistas, if you will, the career vistas for young hockey players in America. They were getting contracts. And then ESPN starts in the late 70s. So everything swirls around and begins to change. By 1980, it's quite a different hockey world.
And one of the other things you point out in the book is that in 1980, when Al Michaels and that crew went to Lake Placid, they didn't have a whole lot of experience doing hockey. It was pretty new for ABC. And do you think in any way that led to the way they projected the whole Olympics that year?
When you say projected, what do you mean?
Well, I mean, it seems to me that a lot of the sort of politicizing of that particular event was sort of sprung from the way that it was broadcast. I mean, we saw the 1960 games mostly on tape delay until the end, and I remember seeing little guys on my little black and white TV playing, but it was more, once it became more of a spectacle, it was almost as if it became bigger than hockey. It became bigger than the Olympics in a way that might not have been possible in 1960.
I think that's true. Of course, by the time in the lead up to the games at Lake Placid, there already are issues about the politics and Jimmy Carter talking about boycotting Moscow, that the Summer Olympics that were going to be held later that year. So there was certainly, surrounding the Olympics overall, more of a political environment. But as far as hockey goes, there was such low expectation for the U.S. team, especially
right
when they got blown out in Madison Square Garden, that nobody was talking about the U.S. being a weapon of propaganda against the Soviets, because no one expected it. But once they started to win, and I'll tell you this, Bruce, if you remember that last-minute goal by Buzz Baker against Sweden to get the tie, if he hadn't scored that goal, I think everything would have been different.
Yeah, I remember the miracle well. Now
yeah,
you played hockey at Bowdoin, correct?
I did.
Yeah.
Yep.
As a young man growing up playing hockey, when you knew you weren't going to go to the NHL, I mean, I'm not sure. I'm 66, and I think I still might get there. Was there something about the game itself that kept you in it that in some way harkens back to the big moments on the international stage?
By the way, you also played at Vermont Academy, I'm sure.
Yes, I did.
And Mike Tsoukas, was he your coach?
Mike wasn't, actually. Mike had been the coach, but he was headmaster then, so a different guy was the coach. Bob Hutchinson was the coach. And
if you were 2 years younger, I might have been your coach, because I taught and coached there from 70 to 72.
Yeah, I graduated in 69. That's interesting.
Right, I know that. Small world.
Small world.
Well, anyway, back to your question, what were the things that people of my generation say at Bowdoin, which at the time, things were so different in college hockey, and Bowdoin had a great coach, Sid Watson, and a very good rink for the time. So, and the tuition difference, the differential in cost was much lower, and
right,
most of the Division I schools, particularly in the Boston area, did not have a full complement of scholarships, so they were parceling out partial scholarships to people. So the bottom line is, the difference in cost to go to a Bowdoin or to go to a BU, say, was not so great as it quickly became. So we had, I was fortunate. My twin brother and I got to play with, let me count them up, five guys who made All-America status.
Wow.
And when I was at Bowdoin, half or almost half our schedule was Division One teams. So
right.
When I was there, we played Providence, Dartmouth, we played Army, Merrimack was moving to Division One, always moving with a heavily stocked Canadian team. UVM was on the threshold of going Division One.
Yep.
We played out in a tournament out in Cleveland against McGill, and Bowling Green was out there. And so the scheduling was such that there wasn't such a great distinction between what was called the college division and the university division. And the NCAA had it only split in two in 1966. Prior to that, everybody was in the same division. And those of you in the Maine area who followed hockey for a long time can remember those great Colby teams with Jack Kelly, who were playing for the Eastern Championship. They made the Eastern Championship with Ronnie Ryan and those players. So the differences were not so great. For us, for my generation, to play top-level college hockey, and then if you were good enough, which I wasn't, but if you were good enough, you might get a shot at the national team.
Well, Steve, it's a fascinating piece. I'm rereading the end of it here as you're talking, when the IIHF ranked their top moments and top teams of all time. Of course, 1980 came in at number one, 1960 at number 16, but they also point out the incredible accomplishment of that Squaw Valley team beating the top four teams in the world to win that gold medal.
And the thing about 60 was, remember, Canada was still the top dog in those days. By 1980, Canada had dropped out of international hockey in 71, around there, in protesting the fact that the Soviets were not amateurs. No one felt they were truly amateurs, and the best Canadian players, professionals, weren't allowed to play. So they boycotted international hockey. But in 1960, they were still the team to beat, and you know who their captain was?
No.
Harry Sinden.
Oh, wow. Wow. That is great. Well, Steve, thank you so much for being with us. It's part of this wonderful collection, Replays, Rivalries, and Rumbles. Steve's contribution is Remembering and Forgetting America's Hockey Miracles. Thanks so much for being with us this afternoon.
My pleasure, guys.